I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Sarah Gran, author of the new novel, The Book of the Most Precious Substance. We talked about writing autobiographical fiction, revision, and her new publishing company, Dreamland Books. I hope you enjoy our talk as much as I did. So it's so good to talk to you again. I had fun with you on the Sisters in Crime panel a couple of weeks ago, and I just wanted to talk to you more after that.
Thank you. That was such a fun panel. Thank you for having me and for putting it together. And, yeah, it was a fun time.
It was. So the Book of the Most Precious Substance, published by Dreamland Books, Los Angeles. Tell me how this story came about.
I think all these stories, everything that I write comes about because I'll have an idea I've been messing around with for a while and can't quite make it work. And then another idea comes along that does make it work. So I'd always wanted to do something in the rare book world. I had always wanted to do something that was a sort of more accessible, straightforward thriller, you know? And I used to really enjoy my paperback mysteries and thrillers that I would pick up at a bookshop or an airport for a bad day. And I couldn't really find any that I wanted to read anymore. And it's always the never-ending good advice to write what you want to read. At least it makes your workday fun if you're excited to go back to your project, if nothing else.
Mm. What did you grow up reading? What were you into?
I grew up reading a lot. I was very, very fortunate. My parents were very into books. I grew up in a house full of books. We had great libraries, great bookstores. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, which has always been a really hyper-literate town. Even in these sort of dark days of the 70s and 80s, there were a ton of just books everywhere with the publishing industry there and a well-educated population. And that was just an incredibly fortunate thing. And I read everything. I used to love, my fondest memories are going to this little bookstore in upstate New York I used to go to with my mother. I think it's called the Chatham Bookstore, Chatham, New York. We used to spend some time there. And I really remember, you know, they would buy me anything. They would let me read pretty much anything I wanted to, which was wonderful. And I would pick out these books about like Bigfoot, Bermuda Triangle. Is Bigfoot real? Still not sure. Bermuda Triangle. Don't think there's too much to that one. You know, all of these crazy, crazy things. And they never questioned that. My family was just like, cool, that's what you want to read. Go for it. Read it. All good. Do whatever you want.
Now, have you also been a book collector or into antiquarian books? Or
I can't afford antiquarian books, but I was a bookseller for many years. I worked in new and used bookstores for many years through most of my 20s, which was definitely an incredible education on books. I worked in the Strand with someone wonderful who I just saw passed away recently, Ben McFall, who was the head of the fiction department for years. He was a huge part of my book education. We worked in the same geographical location of the Strand for years when I worked in the paperback department, and I got an incredible education from him. And then when my book started selling enough that I didn't have to work full time if I was willing to live in abject poverty, which was fine with me for a little while, but I still needed to make money, I would go to book sales, library sales, things like that, estate sales, and pick up things to sell for some extra money.
And so Lily Albrecht, the protagonist of the Book of the Most Precious Substance, is a book collector and seller. Talk about coming up with her character and her story, too, because she had this idyllic relationship with her husband. Husband, they married at some point.
Yes, and, yes, husband.
And he's disabled and... And she goes about, I mean, it's her story, but she has all this stuff happening in her life. So, you know, talk about creating her and giving her all this kind of baggage to deal with.
Well, honestly, a lot of that baggage is autobiographical. When I started the book, my parents were very ill. I did not know they were dying, but they were dying. And my husband was very ill and I was dealing with all of this health stuff. So unfortunately, a lot of that stuff is autobiographical and just this unrelenting grind. And there's a lot of good that comes from caring for people. And there's a lot that's beautiful and wonderful about it, but it is also an unrelenting grind. I don't want to backtrack too much on that. I want to include there's something really wonderful about helping your parents clean themselves and care for themselves as they did for you. If you're lucky enough to have, you know, decent parents, who you can have mm-hmm. that kind of relationship with. And my parents were batshit crazy, but wonderful. And to see the frailty of the body as it gets older and to respect that and honor that. My father had Alzheimer's. But it is also incredibly hard work and incredibly undervalued work. And in our particular time and place, it is work that alienates you from other people, you know, the caregiving to other human beings. Certainly in my slice of American society, in the upper middle class, mostly white echelons of society, that is really, really looked down on. A lot of people were very confused as to why I was doing that for my family. And I have a couple friends who just exited altogether. I can think of two people in particular who were pretty good friends when I was like a cool, fun, glamorous writer, relatively glamorous, and who just didn't really want to talk to me anymore when my days were about, you know, the schedules and the changes and the bathing and all of that. And it's a profound job, but also, like I said, it's alienating and it's a fucking drag as well. So, and like I said, the isolation of that and the lack of connection so many people have to that, and me being a little early among my friend groups too, I think was really confusing to some people because my parents were a bit older than they had me. So that was a big inspiration for the book, and that ended up seeming like the perfect setting. And of course, when you have these experiences, you're very eager to write about them.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, autobiographical fiction, it seems that a lot of writers, when they write autobiographical fiction, they like to make it, put it in the third person. So no one thinks it's really about them, but you don't seem to have any problem with that, right?
I don't really enjoy writing in the third person. I wrote a little novella over the summer in the third person, and it was right for that piece. I'll publish it sometime this year, probably. And I enjoy doing it for that limited piece. I can't imagine writing a whole book in the third person. For me, it's just too hard to get into that internal life, that mm-hmm. immediacy. And it's fun to make a little guessing game for your readers. Is this real? Is this her? Is this fictional? I don't do it on purpose, but we can have fun with it.
So then with Lily, I mean, you know, Lily is not you. And so how much did you know going in? I mean, do you have to really know the character before you start writing? Do you have to know what the problems are going to be? I mean, how much did you know before going into this novel?
I knew pretty much nothing. I don't actually remember. I remember writing this less than I remember writing any of my other books, which is something I realized as I was getting the last draft ready for publication. And a lot of it is because I was written at my parents' house and their dining room table, you know, in between running to the store and dealing with a real estate agent. But I never really have. I think the fun in writing is discovering it as you go. That's not for every writer. Everybody's different. But for me, that's a big part of the fun of writing a book, is getting to know these characters as you continue.
Do you have an MFA?
No. And I didn't majored in cultural anthropology in college. So I have very little formal writing education. I took a couple classes, did not like them. I am not if writers' workshops are helpful for other people, that's a good thing. I have found them to be utterly non-helpful and catering to the lowest common denominator. But I know other people have had good experiences with them and found them.
Right. But it's interesting because, I wonder how you're writing, how this book would have been different if you'd been in an MFA program or you'd run it through a writer's group or critique group. I mean, I found it just so compelling, and you got this such an excellent review in the New York Times on Sunday, which
thank you.
I was so happy to see that. And as she, who was it? Danielle Trissoni, as she says at the end, she says, Grand's plotting is hairpin in its curvature. Her descriptions of desire, sexy and subtle. Like Lily Albrecht, readers have little choice but to follow the book to its sinister conclusion. I mean, that's such a great.
It's so nice. It's so gratifying to get a review that's not just positive, but also seems like someone who genuinely mm-hmm. got the book, liked it for the reasons you want your reader to like it, which is not always the case. And of course, it's good if people like it for any reason at all. There's no wrong reason to like a book, but it is particularly gratifying when someone writes a review that says everything you wanted to hear and to be really crass is going to drive sales in a way that other good reviews mm-hmm. don't. I've had other books that have had much bigger print size reviews that drove sales not at all. And this one is already driving sales in a really huge way because of this beautiful enthusiasm. So thank you, New York Times.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do you think might have changed if you had subjected the book to a lot of readers before finalizing, before publishing?
Well, that was one reason why I used this book to start my own press, is because I did not think it would benefit from that process. And I do write some things that do need an editor for sure. Like my next book is going to be the next book of my detective series. I will definitely need a good editor for that. And if I'm lucky, I will get to work with my British editor, Angus Cargill at Faber, on that book. But for this book, I turned it into everyone. It's a finished manuscript for all my foreign publishers, I mean. And, you know, you're taking it or leaving it, basically. And I knew that the sex would weird people out. There's a lot of sex in the book, and some of it's fairly explicit. And I knew that the magic would weird people out. Mm-hmm. And I knew that it would not be a good book to subject really to anyone else's opinion. I had two agents over the course of this book, and both of them gave me some helpful notes. And both of them also gave me a lot of notes that I didn't take. I just thought it's a clear shot. It's a straight shot. She's looking for the book. She goes around the world to find the book. That's it. I didn't feel like I needed any help with the plot, because the plot is actually this one very straight line. And like I said, all of these sort of difficult to talk about topics. I felt like if I had worked with someone else, the sex would have been either put more sex in and make it straightforward erotica, or take some of it out, or people don't really do this in bed, or is this a real thing that people do? And those were not conversations I wanted to have. And those were not conversations that I thought would improve the book at all.
Yeah. So what about, I'm trying to think about subplots, because there's the sick husband, which I suppose is a subplot, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe.
Sorry.
That's all right. But I mean, are you thinking that way? Like A story, B story, C story, D story. Are you thinking like that? Are you thinking this is the story? She needs to find this particular book, and that's the story. That's what we're going to do.
That's how I thought of it as I was writing it. This is the story. She needs the book for this various reason. So I didn't think of it as like an A book, an A plot, and a B plot. And again, I write these detective novels that have these really complicated stories, and they can have like four or five plots going at once. Mm-hmm. So that is a separate beast. For this, it seemed to me very straightforward. One thing: she's going after the book. Is she going to get the book, and what's going to happen when she gets it?
Yeah. I mean, I like that. What did I read recently? It must have been a novella. It was Cornell Woolrich's, I don't know if it was called Rear Window, but it was the story that Rear Window was made from. And it was just, it was one story. I mean, it wasn't like the movie where there's all this other stuff going on.
You know? Yeah. But yeah.
One story. Kind of like that.
Yeah, like I said, I wrote the thing I wanted to read, which was something that would be engaging and compelling. And luckily, I have sort of taught myself how to do that over the years after 25 years of doing this. It's like I wanted to write something that would be utterly absorbing for like a day. I was thinking what would be like beach reading or a day at the pool for someone who is really literate and doesn't want just like a straightforward romance or thriller, but wants that completely engrossing, can't put it down reading experience.
Yeah, I had that. I mean, that happened to me because I must have requested it from your publicist. Somebody had sent me something about it, and I said, yeah, I want to see this book. And then it came in, and I just had to read it.
Thank you. That is wonderful to hear. Thank you.
It was wonderful. So I guess Claire DeWitt, she is your mystery detective.
Yes.
And so you were taking a break from that to do this, and you're going back to Claire?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So for that, I mean, talk about the difference. You said a few things about, you know, maybe what the difference is. Oh, I mean, you like your editors or agents or whatever to deal with that, but this, you just wanted to have it be you. Why? I mean, was it really the subject matter more than anything else, or was it because you started a publishing company, or, you know, talk a little bit about that.
It's the nature of the books. You know, I'm proud of that series. I love that series, but I have made some really fucking stupid mistakes as a writer in that series, which is I've made it so incredibly complicated and I have made this world. Mm-hmm. And again, I love it and readers seem to like it, which is a wonderful thing. And I feel very, very lucky for all the fans I have for that series. But I have dug myself into these plot holes where there is so much just double checking that needs to be done. Like, mm-hmm. no, this person died in 1985. You can't have them in something in 1987. And I also really aim to be sort of push boundaries with structure with those books. Whereas this book was the opposite. This book was the book of the most precious substances. Like I said, straightforward, straight shot going after the book. The Claire DeWitt books, the mystery books are like these elaborate structures with multiple storylines mm-hmm. going on and such a huge world that I have created around them for better or worse. I think better for the reader, worse for me. It'll take me about 35 years to write that next book at the rate I'm going.
Yeah, but I see, because there's so many things going on in the book that you need other eyes on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I really like for every book in the series to work as part of the series, but also as a standalone book. And in that area, it does really help to get fresh eyes on it. Like if you had never read the other books, would this make sense to you? Would it work as a standalone novel, which is important to me?
In your first novel, Come Closer was a standalone, wasn't it?
Yes. That was my second book, actually.
Second one? Yes.
I have my first three books were standalone books. Then the three series books. Then this year I had an audio original that was written as a novel. I will publish that someday. So I count that as half a book because it's not in print yet. And this. And that was always the idea, was to go back and forth between this series, which I love doing, but also doing these other one at a time projects.
So this novel felt somewhat noirish, not quite, you know, the darkish noir, but it had these noir elements. And I think Come Closer did too. I think I was looking up noir some time ago and found Come Closer. Wherever I was looking for it, Scribd, I think it was. I think it was in that category. Are you thinking noir at all when you were writing the book of the most precious substance or Come Closer or your standalones?
You know, I am a huge noir fan, so I think that's sort of a big influence on everything that I do. And I am a big film noir fan in particular. There's so many noir authors who I like from that 30s, 40s, 50s era, especially, you know, Raymond Chandler and Jim Thompson mm-hmm. are my favorites. But I am also a big film noir fan. I just had a good text thread going with some friends the other day, trading these sort of lesser known noirs we had not seen yet. So it is a huge influence on everything I do, that dark, mm-hmm. Straightforward and yet incredibly twisty and twisted frame of storytelling.
The ending of the book of the most precious substance felt so noir to me. And it also, I think I was talking about this on the panel the other week, where it reminded me of what Robert McGee in his book Story says, that the best endings are ironic. And I found it such an ironic ending. Talk about the ending. When did you know that was how it was going to end?
I don't remember. It definitely came through the writing process. And, you know, I knew it had to have a certain tone at the ending to be true to the book. And I think other people have said this before, and I would give them credit if I could remember, because it's not an original idea. But I do think the ending of a book should feel both surprising and inevitable. You know, the idea is you really want it to feel like, oh, I didn't see this coming. I didn't think of this, but also it could not have ended any other way.
Would you read?
Yes.
Okay.
So I am going to read here a section from the middle of the book, but I don't think it requires too much setup. It is, as I said, Lily Albrecht looking for a book. That is the plot of this book. And in this particular scene, she is in France, going from Paris to a place on the countryside, which you will find out about in this reading, where she has gotten a lead on the book.
Okay.
The train from Paris to the countryside was beautiful and, being France, delicious. The ride was about 2 hours. A little ham sandwich and a hot chocolate from the train station cafe ranked with the best meal in the upstate town where I lived. Once we flew past the suburbs, the countryside was green, lush, and damp. Farms and wetlands interspersed with thick woods. I got off the train in a small, dense city and hailed a taxi. In fumbling French, I tried and failed to communicate my destination to the driver. Finally, I just showed him my phone where I had been sent the email with instructions, and his old Gaelic face lit up with recognition. Oui, he said, Le Chateau. I'm going to apologize in advance for some bad French that will come out in this reading. We drove through the cobblestone streeted town, through a ring of placid suburbs, and out to the countryside. There were fields of corn and apple orchards and pig farms, dotted with the occasional bigger, wealthier home. After a 30-minute drive and 1,000 roundabouts, the driver turned down a smaller, unpaved, two-lane road into a wooded area, then another even narrower road, and then onto a long gravel driveway, where we drove up to an iron gate. At the gate, he buzzed an intercom, exchanged a few words in French about une femme américaine, non, je ne sais, and the gate swung open. We drove down the driveway for at least another 5 minutes, woods on either side, until we came to a mile-wide clearing of bright green grass with an ancient house in the middle of it, easily from the 1600s. It was not huge and was made out of rough stone that made it look more like a church than a home. On all sides of the lawn were woods that looked older than the house. To one side was an elaborate garden, to another a gazebo, and later I'd see that behind the house were stables, sheds, and a few other outbuildings. I hardly knew old money came quite so old. The car stopped about 10 feet from the entryway to the house. As I got out, I saw a small, open, horse-drawn carriage pull up from a path in the woods and approach the house. Inside the ornate black carriage were three women. I could hear them laughing as I walked up to the house. One of the women had white blonde hair and wore a black bustier and a long, full black skirt. She had red lipstick on her lips and big, round, dark glasses over her eyes. Soon I would learn she was Cat, French Chinese, somewhere between 40 and 70. A second woman, much younger, had long, wavy blonde hair that cascaded down her back and wore jeans and a lace-trimmed camisole top. She had no makeup on and beat-up sneakers on her feet. That was Carrie Ann. The third woman, Maud, about my own age, had steel gray hair swept into an updo and wore a black suit with a thin transparent t-shirt underneath, revealing her taut waist and high small breasts. I stopped walking and watched them. Now I saw the carriage wasn't driven by horses. It was driven by two people with large elaborate horse masks over their faces and black leather or synthetic costumes covering their bodies. Still laughing, the woman in the black suit, Maud, pulled the reins on the horse people, telling them to stop a few yards from the house. Cat, the woman in the bustier, stood up. She had a long leather whip in her hand. Expertly, she lashed the whip. They made a loud cracking sound and caught both horse people across their backs. One stood perfectly, rigidly still. The other shivered a little when the whip touched his back. "Why, hello," Cat called out to me. "You must be the American. Come in. We're having a late lunch and you must join us."
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's great to hear it. As you were reading, I was thinking about the midpoint of the book and if that's something you pay attention to. I mean, is the midpoint of a project important to you? Are you paying attention to what happens there and what comes after?
Yeah, I don't take it literally, but I do tend to divide books up into quarters just for my sort of own understanding of where the book is going. Mm-hmm. A lot of writers, sorry, I'm about to sneeze. Sorry. Mm-hmm. A lot of writers rely on three-act structure. That's great if that works for them. My brain sort of always goes to fours. So I always sort of go to what are we working towards? What is in the middle here? Where is the story going? I really enjoy paying attention to structure and plot. And to see how that sort of affects the whole reading experience. And if you are producing the effect you have wanted to produce, whatever that may be.
What's your revision process then?
Do you
barrel through
what? Endless.
Do you barrel through and just get the first draft down and then deal with it? Or are you fixing it as you go along?
Both. I will make a lot of changes as I go. And then once I have a completed manuscript, go through that many times. So for me, it's a really, really long, involved, engaging process.
What do you do when you hit a wall in the writing of a book of this? I don't know if you did with this book, if there were any points along the way where you just go, I don't know what's going to happen. what do you do? Or do you just, are you beyond that? You just keep going. And
I wouldn't say beyond that, but it's not really a problem I have. The problem I have is more about, I have all of these things that I think would be cool. They can't all fit in this book. It would be a stupid book if you shoved all this stuff in there just because it's cool. How are you going to select what to include? And then if I don't want to work on something, I don't mind taking some time off. I'm not one of those writers who works from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. every day. I work when I want to work. I always have other stuff to do that is work related. I always have a backlog of emails to answer and letters to write and books to mail and websites that have gone unupdated and meetings to have. So as long as you're staying busy and being productive, I am not of the write every day school. I am of the school of, you know, if it takes you a couple weeks to figure out that plot point, it's fine. It's not a wall. Just go do something else. It's just like a little door you didn't open all the way yet.
What about Dreamland? Talk about starting a publishing company and why you did that.
It's something I've always wanted to do. It's always kind of been the goal and my dream to have my own publishing company. And as I said before, there were a lot of reasons why I thought this book was the right book to start that with. And also I just kind of got to a point in age and crankiness level where I didn't want to collaborate on these books anymore. I've worked with some amazing publishers and had some wonderful experiences and worked with incredible teams who brought stuff to the book that I never could have brought. And I've had negative experiences too, like all writers. I wanted to do it myself because I wanted to make the decisions myself about things like the cover and the copy that we're using and how we position it in the marketplace. And I hired a bunch of people. I did this like a very expensive way. There's cheaper ways to do it. And I hired a bunch of people to help, which was the fancy way to do it, but it paid off. And they were all wonderful to work with. But I lost my train of thought, yeah, I mean, collaboration could be a wonderful thing, but I had gotten to the point where I just sort of wanted to try doing it all myself, thinking maybe I'll hate it and maybe then I'll understand why the people I work with sometimes do things that don't make sense to me and with a newfound respect to them. And I do have a newfound respect to how hard their job is, but I cannot imagine going back unless sales are an utter disaster, and we'll find out in a few days. If they are, I might reconsider. But nothing short of that would really lead me to go back. Like I screwed up so much and I made so many mistakes, but it was still a really wonderful experience.
Now, are you publishing other books? Are you planning to do that?
I will in the future. Yeah. I don't think I'm quite ready for that yet. I need to make all my mistakes on myself first before I screw up someone else's life, because we don't want to do that to anybody. But yeah, eventually the goal is to publish like 2 to 4 books a year.
And then you do other things too. You write for TV.
Yes, I write for TV and film as well.
So how does that work with book writing? I mean, bless you. Do they occupy different parts of the brain so you can go, bless you again, one to the other? Is it like, okay, I'm in the book right now. I'm going to be doing the book right now. 2 months from now, I'm ready to do this for film or TV. I mean, how do you juggle projects?
It gets hard sometimes for sure, because it does occupy a different part of your brain. And I like it. The main reason I work in Hollywood is for the money, right? You'd have to be crazy to really do it for the satisfaction or the love of the art. That's not the way to approach it. That's the way to approach independent filmmaking, perhaps. But working in Hollywood, your best bet is to accept that you're there for the money. But also, I really enjoy it because it does use a different part of my brain. It's a really different kind of collaboration. And as a writer, you do occupy a really different position than you do when you're working with publishers. It's interesting because when you work with a publisher, you've written the whole book, and then your opinions on everything else are sort of discounted. And when you work in Hollywood as a writer, you are a much smaller piece of the team, but you are also usually a producer on your own project. And you are expected to produce. You're expected to pick up that phone and call people and make decisions and contribute to, give visual input, give input on sound and things like that. So I really enjoy it. It's a different skill set and it is a lot of fun, but it is hard to balance it all because Hollywood can be very all consuming, you know, and I've always tried to figure out how can I do this sort of part time. I don't need that much money. I don't need to make millions of dollars a year. I wouldn't know what to do with that. I'd rather work less and have a lot more time to write books. but it's hard to be in the business part way. That's the challenge. But I'm figuring it out.
So from Brooklyn, you went to the Bay Area?
Oh, I've lived all over. I went from Brooklyn to Florida, to New Orleans, to a couple different places in the Bay Area, and now a few different places in LA.
And do you have a favorite place?
Oh, no. I like being in LA just because I have a bunch of friends here. I know a lot of people here, but it's not my, I love LA. I'm happy to be here, but it's not, you know, the most magnificent city on planet Earth. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Every place has their pros and cons, and there's wonderful people anywhere. Another great thing about working in Hollywood is that you constantly meet sort of these cool, interesting people who have come to LA from all over the world to make money in this business. And that's another kind of good reason to stay here.
Mm-hmm. An editor I know, a writer and editor in New York said just the other day, he's like, you know, they live, I don't know, the Upper East Side, Upper West Side, and said, you know, we have to leave. We want to leave here. It's not a writer's town anymore.
No, any city that gets that expensive, you're really going to feel it in the arts, because you really cannot afford to. If you have a city where you can't just work and get by with a kind of crappy job, mm-hmm. you can't just work in a bookstore, which can be a wonderful job, but I mean, in terms of pay, it can be a crappy job. Wait tables in a not fine dining establishment. I know in fine dining, it can pay quite well. If you can't just kind of get by, artists can't live there. And LA is reaching that point too. Although again, it is a bit different because we do have this film industry here, which is one of the very few places on earth creative weirdos can make money.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, once you reach that level of expensiveness, you're going to lose your artists. And then the cycle begins all over again, because, you know, people want to live where artists are. That is always sort of the developers and or gentrifiers, however you want to look at it. You know, think about, I mean, I lived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in the 90s. My husband moved there in the 80s, you know, and it was not a very safe neighborhood. Shit happened all the time that was not safe and not okay at all. But it was better than going to work for Goldman Sachs or whatever the hell else people do to make money, you know? There are no neighborhoods like that in New York anymore. Or maybe there are, and I don't know. I haven't lived in New York in almost 20 years. And in LA, neighborhoods like that are becoming very scarce.
Yeah.
So, but then once people who are cool and interesting don't want to live in a city anymore, then everything else sort of trickles out and then the rents will come down. So it's always a cycle. That's one nice thing about getting old, is seeing this cycle play out. And New York is heading for a 70s style breakdown. It looks like all big cities in America are, which will be horrible in many ways, but rents will come down. They'll be affordable. And then in 10 or 15 years, this cycle will pick back up again.
Interesting. So back to the book of the most precious substance, will you go back to Lily? Will she show up in anything else that you're writing?
Maybe. I definitely left that door open, but I don't have any specific plans. You know, I don't feel like I have to continue that story, but there are a lot of interesting things that could continue that story.
Mm. And you mentioned Chandler. Who else? Who else are you either influenced by, or who else do you love to read and has an effect on you? And, or if you buy gifts and you're giving books other than your own, what do you give?
It's always the same three people, my Holy Trinity: Raymond Chandler, Shirley Jackson, Charles Portis. A really good friend of mine just read We've Always Lived in the Castle, Shirley Jackson's amazing book. Probably my favorite book, her last novel, for the first time. And she's like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I'm like, I've been telling you for 10 years. For me, those three always stand out. And I don't know why, but I am always attracted to these sort of mid-century or, you know, slightly later, Charles Portis's books are 60s, 70s, 80s American writers. For some reason, that is always my where my heart goes. I don't know why.
I haven't read him, Charles Portis.
The Dog of the South is possibly the funniest book ever written. And Gringos is a wonderful book. All of his books are wonderful, but my two favorite are The Dog of the South and Gringos. And of course, True Grit. He wrote the book True Grit that the film was based on.
Of course.
I wish I could remember it. I'm going to mangle it if I try to do it, but it has possibly the best first line in all of American fiction. You can get a little ebook sample from Kindle or iBooks or whatever you get your ebooks and read that first line. And I guarantee anyone listening, you will not want to stop reading after you read that first line. And about- the last line too, sorry to interrupt. That That's book right. possibly has the best first line and the best last line of any book in American history.
Which is no small feat with, you know, great last lines, because it's so hard to end. Right. I mean, isn't it?
It sure is.
A really satisfying ending.
I think that's why I struggle with short stories and why I very rarely write them, because a lot more beginnings and endings, which are the hardest thing. It sounds like a very sort of prosaic, stupid reason to struggle with something. But so many short stories in my life I've started and could not bring to an ending without the weight of an entire 200-page book behind it.
And what about Chandler? What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite of his?
The Long Goodbye, for sure. The Long Goodbye, which is a mystery novel that doesn't really have that much of a mystery in it. There's no real reason for him to be looking for Terry Lennox. He doesn't really have a client at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's nonsensical in a way. And it's just, you know, as Raymond Chandler said, that he writes these mysteries to sort of hang the things he really wants to write on them, which are character portraits and visual descriptions and this sort of poetic view of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm.
Well, in closing, I want to ask you if you have any advice for the novelists who are listening. Or any advice that has been given to you that you've carried with you?
I've never gotten any good advice, probably. Or if I did, I was too stupid to know it. It's probably far more likely now that I think about it. I will give some very prosaic advice. Don't start at the beginning. Start in the middle. Much easier way to write a book. And I will give some more esoteric advice, which is write the book that only you can write. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when you read a book that's gone wrong, that's not good, that you're like, I see something good in here, but that is often a writer trying to do what they think they should do. Do the weird, crazy, bizarre, nonsensical thing that only you could do. And there is a truism in the writing world. I don't know where it comes from, but it is in fact a truism that is literally true. The more specific you write, the more universal you're writing. And mm-hmm. I think that scares some new writers off. Because I think, well, no one will understand this job I have working in a dairy farm. I can't write about my dairy farm job every day. And I can't put in the realistic details of dealing with the cow udders or whatever else goes on at a dairy farm, because no one will relate to that. No one will understand it. No, because if you write about your experience with that, someone somewhere will have an equivalent experience. It is your relationship to the thing, not right. the thing itself, that will shine through and that will make your book something that people cannot put down. I mean, speaking of True Grit, that book is about a 14-year-old girl who goes on in the Old West, who goes on this mission to avenge her father's death. Not topics I have any interest in at all or any relation to at all. The incredible specificity of the character and her journey makes them ironically quite universal.
Have you done anything with your short stories that never became short stories? Have you used them in novels or ever started a novel using one?
Sometimes, yeah. And I do have a bunch of Claire DeWitt short stories that I have finished that I will publish probably next year or maybe even later this year as a book. But I also have a lot of dead ones, which is fine. And not everything has to reach a profitable conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. And I think that's probably one of the difficulties new writers have is, you know, I spent all that time on it. I can't just like put it aside.
Yeah. Right? But you can, because all of your time spent writing is good time. You know, some of it's rehearsal, some of it's practice. Mm-hmm. Like, guitar players practice guitar a lot and they're not saying this is useless, no one's listening. You know, that is not the attitude that's going to get you where you need to go. So I actually think a lot of writers could benefit from more kind of rehearsal time, from more time in those projects that are not going to come to fruition, because you learn a lot from those.
Do you have any novels that are in the bin, in the drawer?
Yeah, a couple. Yeah. I have one that my publisher and agent rejected, and in retrospect, they shouldn't have. And then over the years I tried rewriting it and I did not make it better. I broke all of the good advice I just gave everyone. I broke all of it and I tried to sort of make it more understandable and more approachable, and I screwed it all up. Mm-hmm. I wish I could find the very original copy of it. I don't think I have it, because I would probably just publish it now that I have my own publishing company. And then I have at least one other book. My very, very first book was never published for good reason. It just wasn't good enough. It was I don't want to say an amateurish effort, but I'm glad it wasn't published.
Well, it's been great to talk to you again.
And you too. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Yeah, you're so welcome. I look forward to what you put out next.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for doing this. It's fun to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That was Sarah Graham, author of the book of The Most Precious Substance. If you want to know more about the show or you want to reach out, visit penonfire.com. Thanks for listening.